night. He could slip in through the front door now, up the stairs, fuck her, break her neck and be gone in 10 minutes, in plenty of time to make the flight. The bang on his window sounded like a gunshot. He turned his head, startled, his body instantly coiled for action, his laptop sliding on his dress and wedging against the steering wheel. Peering in through the window, he saw a severe-looking elderly lady in a tweed coat and a Tyrolean hat. He snapped shut the computer lid and hit the button to lower the window. She leaned in and said in a booming voice, "I've seen you've been here for a while. You haven't noticed a small black-and-white dog with pointy ears, have you?" Tooth, gathering his composure, gave a sweet, Thelma Darby, old ladylike smile and shook her head. "His name's Bonzo, and he's a rascal, just a puppy, you see. It must have got out of the hole in our fence. I've been on at my husband to fix it for ages." The woman was looking at him oddly. Had he missed something with his makeup, he wondered. He gave her another sweet Thelma Darby smile. "No? Well, thanks anyway," she said. As he raised the window, there was another sudden sharp rap on it. He lowered it once more, and she peered in again. "By the way, I'm the local neighbourhood watch coordinator. I've had a few calls from people who've noticed you. It's a free world, of course, but we like to keep an eye on strangers. Just so you know." She walked on. As he raised the window once more, he heard her call out loudly, "Bonzo! Bonzo! Come along! Bonzo!" Angry at himself for being so careless, for not noticing her approaching and allowing himself to be startled like that, Tooth started the car and drove for several minutes before stopping again, this time in a lay-by on the main seafront road. He was angry that he'd fucked up. He didn't do fuck-ups. Chapter 107. Friday, the 13th of March. A few minutes after the time they had agreed, 12:30 p.m., Jodie Carmichael stepped out of her taxi in front of the Grand Hotel into the bright sunshine and strong breeze. She had been back home for less than an hour. It had given her time to shower and dress appropriately for a tour of Brighton with, potentially, her next victim. And she was in a good mood. Her hangover was gone after the workout in the gym, shopping for dinner tonight was complete, and her worries about Silas were temporarily parked. Her hair had been done exactly as she liked it. Her fingernails and toenails were manicured and varnished, and she was dressed elegantly in a leopard-skin coat over a grey sweater, leggings, and high-heeled ankle boots. She looked great, she knew. She'd decided not to drive, as she had a feeling that lunch and the afternoon with J. Paul Cornell might well involve more alcohol.
"Wow," he said, striding along the lobby towards her. "Wow!"
She smiled and stared into his eyes. "And right back at you." He was dressed in a mandarin-collared black shirt, buttoned up to the neck, a beautifully tailored charcoal suit, and expensive-looking black loafers.
"I think I just won the lottery," he said.
She grinned. "Me too."
"I thought we'd have a light lunch here. I've a bottle of Moët on ice and 2 lobster salads up in my suite. How does that sound?"
"That sounds rather lovely," she replied with a warm smile. "You wouldn't be planning to seduce me by any chance, would you?"
If my old wedding tackle was up to it, absolutely I would be doing just that, my dear. But I'm afraid my days of seduction are long behind me, so you are in safe hands."
"Isn't that just too bad?" she grinned. "But I'm sure there are other ways." An hour and a half later, the silver Bentley threaded its way through the network of hilly, narrow residential streets. Brighton's White Hawk Estate, on the northeast of the city, lined with post-war semis and bungalows, had some fine views to the south and east. Jodie and Paul lounged back in the rear seats, her right arm linked inside his.
"So this is where you grew up?" she asked.
"Yep, it was pretty rough back then," he drawled. "There were plenty of good, decent folk living here, like my mother. But it was a haven for villains in those days, too, in the 50s. Cops wouldn't leave a car unattended here, because if they did, they'd find it jacked up on blocks with its wheels stolen."
"But it looks nice now," she said.
"Uh-huh."
He was peering intently through the window.
"Make a right here, please, driver," he said.
Then a few moments later he said,
"If I'm right," and it was a long time back, "make a second left."
"How does it feel being back here?" she asked.
"Strange. Like Like nothing's changed, and yet so much has. There weren't so many cars back then, or satellite dishes.
He gave a wistful smile and turned to her.
I keep seeing familiar things, and it's like...
He shrugged and fell silent.
Like what?
He shook his head.
Maybe it was a mistake, bringing you here. Maybe this is not the person I ought to be showing you.
Of course it is. I find you fascinating. I want to know everything about you. I think what you've achieved in your life is incredible.
He reached forward and tapped the driver on the shoulder. Here, stop, stop, he said excitedly. Then he turned to Jody and pointed through her window at a small semi-detached house perched on a rise above them. The garden was a complete junkyard, stacked with busted furniture, rotted doors, a supermarket trolley, a rusted car engine, several tyres, slabs of concrete and old bricks, all lying amid a tangle of weeds.
Interesting art, she said.
That house. That was where I grew up. My mum looked after that garden.
He shook his head.
How does someone let it get like that?
He looked balefully at the neat lawns and flower beds of the neighbouring houses.
Geez, I'm sorry. I guess I made a mistake. I shouldn't have come back.
No, she said. I'm glad you showed me. Nothing stays the same in life, don't you think? It's good to be sentimental sometimes.
He continued to stare, fixated. I can't believe what's happened. My mom was so proud of it.
He shook his head. The past is another country. They do things differently there.
Yep, it sure is. You know, I left here when I was 18. I wonder who lives here now.
Want me to go and knock on the door and find out?
He smiled at her. I'm not sure it's going to be anyone that you or I would want to have a conversation with. So, why don't you tell me more about yourself? He asked. You said last night you were from Brighton. Where was your family home?
Instantly he saw she looked uncomfortable. Oh, yes, originally, but we moved a lot because of my dad's work.
What did he do?
He worked for a bank, and they moved him around the country. We were constantly uprooted, you know. It was tough as a kid, always changing schools. You just make a new set of friends, then you have to say goodbye to them and move on again.
Where in the city were you born?
In some maternity unit. I don't honestly remember where it was.
And what about your parents? Are they still alive?
No.
I'm sorry, he said.
He told the driver to move on, to take them to the Dorothy Stringer School where he was educated.
All the while, as they drove, he kept up a running commentary about the places of his youth. And all the while, he fed Jody subtle questions, trying to get her to talk more about herself. But she fielded each question either with a lie, or by telling him that it was too painful to delve into her past. By the time the limousine turned into the drive of her Rodine Crescent house just after 6 p.m, he had gleaned virtually no more about her than he knew when they had started out. But he did know his handler would now see from the GPS tracker their exact location.
Nice home you have, he said, as the car pulled up by the front door. I like the style. How would you define it? Tudor Revival?
She laughed. Have you really been away from England for that long you've forgotten? The style is mock Tudor.
Ah, right, sure, I get that. But your home seems more than just mock.
Maybe that's your natural beauty enhancing it, he said with a twinkle. Flattery will get you everywhere. If you have time, I'll give you the $5 tour.
I'll make the time. Hell, we have all evening.
Cup of tea and some of my homemade cake when we get in, she asked.
It would be rude to refuse.
It would be. Very rude. And you haven't changed your mind about staying for dinner, have you?
Well, I guess it would also be very rude to do that.
She leaned across and kissed him on the cheek. I like you, she said. I like you a lot.
The driver opened the boot of the car and Cornell removed a heavy butler's wine cellar bag. Handing it to her, he said, I've got some champagne, red wine, and white wine from this local wine store the concierge recommended earlier.
So you figured out I like a drink?
Judging by last night and the amount of champagne we got through at lunch, I guessed.
He smiled. So, what time should I tell my driver to come pick me up tonight?
she whispered in his ear. How about around midday tomorrow?
Chapter 108, Friday the 13th of March.
I have the address. Looks like 191 Rodine Crescent. Potting's gone into her house, sir, the undercover monitor said to Roy Grace over the phone. Cake and tea, and then she's cooking him dinner.
Lucky sod, Grace replied. Thanks for the update. So the address confirms the location we thought. No other information?
Nothing significant, sir. He's doing a convincing job, but she's revealing nothing.
Keep me updated.
Yes, of course, sir. I'm going off shift at 8 p.m, handing over to Andy Clark.
Okay, thanks.
I'll be back on at 8 a.m.
Have a good evening.
Thank you, sir. It's my husband's birthday. I'll be drinking orange juice.
Enjoy.
Huh.
Grace stood and looked at the map of Brighton and Hove and located Rodine Crescent. He knew the area. So now Norman Potting was there, with the target, and it was likely Tooth would know it by now too. He rang the ACC, advising him that the UCU might be in increased danger. With the knowledge that there could well be venomous reptiles in the property, he told Pew he would speak to Nick Sloan to discuss round-the-clock armed response unit surveillance. He also added that if they were to attempt an entry to the house to rescue him, should anything go wrong, they would additionally need an expert on venomous reptiles to be present, and that was in hand.
Roy, Pew said, you know how stretched we are. Do we have the resources to protect UC adequately? If not, you'll need to consider pulling him out, if you don't want anything that happens to him to be on your conscience.
Sir, so far everything has gone according to plan, like clockwork. I think he'll deliver. We just need to make him safe.
Was going into her home part of our plan?
Pew questioned. Absolutely, sir.
You believe she might keep venomous reptiles there, and you haven't already arranged for an expert to be on hand? Do you realise the consequences for Sussex Police if he was bitten?
I have arranged an expert, and I've a lot of faith in our officer.
Good to hear that, Roy, he whined. I'm glad somebody does.
Grace hung up. God, he hated that man. Why the hell hadn't he let him fall to his death over Beachy Head? It was a question he had asked himself so many times. He'd saved his life, and this was his reward. One day Pew would get his true comeuppance. But right now, Roy's priority was Potting's safety and arresting that bitch on murder charges that would stick. He vitally needed better evidence. He called DS Tanya Cale and asked her to confirm that Dr. Reardon, the snake expert from London Zoo, was on his way down to Brighton for the pre-search planning meeting. He then rang the on-call Gold Commander to brief him on the current deployment of a UC at No. 191 Rodine Crescent and the possible need for an ARV unit to attend in an emergency. Grace was not pleased to hear that due to the shortage of manpower, there might not be a surveillance unit available immediately. He knew that Potting should be able to take care of himself, and that he had a panic alert on his iPhone which would send a unit over at once should he need it. The Gold Commander, Chief Superintendent Nev Kemp, told him he would talk to Silver and sort out the necessary resources. Grace ended the call and sat frustrated. 5 years ago, if he'd needed an armed surveillance unit to safeguard Potting, there would have been one at scene within 30 minutes, and a rota of units would have remained there for as long as it took. Now it would take some while to arrange. Great. Grace stared down at the files on his desk. Updates on Crisp, Jody, and Tooth. He glanced at his watch. 3:05 p.m. He frowned. It had to be later than that. Much later. He shook it and realized it had stopped. It was a chunky swatch that Glenn Branson had made him buy some while ago when he had insisted on taking him fashion shopping for a makeover when Grace had first begun to date Cleo. Probably needed a new battery. He glanced at his iPhone. 6:20 p.m. Then he saw the date. It was Friday the 13th today. Parascava decatriophobix was the word for people who had a fear of this date, but it had never bothered him. The only superstition he had ever taken note of, if it could even be called a superstition, was a full moon. In his early days in the police, as a beat copper in Brighton, it always seemed there was a rise in violent incidents whenever there was a full moon. One of his colleagues, some years back,
had actually made a study and had concluded that it was true. He felt at this moment like a juggler holding a whole bunch of spinning plates in the air. He had a female killer on the loose in Brighton, a fugitive serial killer somewhere in France or Europe or anywhere in the world by now, and an American killer for hire playing cat and mouse all over the city, and a boss who would give anything to blame him for failing to lock all three up. The only useful thing he had right now, thanks to Norman Potting, was Jodie Carmichael's address, and some rather flimsy circumstantial evidence against her. He was relying heavily on Potting finding something with which they could nail her. Friday the 13th. Hell, it had to be a lucky day for someone.
Chapter 109. Friday the 13th of March. Tooth, munching a pulled pork wrap and sipping a Coke in an almost deserted golf course car park half a mile away, watched the afternoon progress into evening. Lemon cake and tea gave way to champagne and canapés. Oh, Jodie, he thought with grudging admiration, you are a true pro. The tubby American was reveling in her attentions. Right now he was lounging on a sofa, stroking a cat and holding a freshly refilled glass of bubbly. Meanwhile she was busy in the kitchen, swigging his champagne as she cooked. She wasn't going to be driving that Merc anywhere tonight. But the one bit of good news was that she seemed to have persuaded him to cancel his limousine for tomorrow and to let her take him on a further drive around the Sussex of his youth in her car instead. Tooth decided he might as well abandon his vigil for tonight and go find a hotel within easy striking distance, but outside of Grace's likely search area. He googled and found several in the vicinity of Gatwick Airport, where he'd stayed on his last visit. There was a Hilton at Gatwick. Hiltons were pretty anonymous places. He checked online and booked himself a room. Erotic flashes of Jodie Carmichael naked in front of her mirror returned to his mind. There'd be plenty of hookers he could find online who'd be willing to come to an airport hotel like the Hilton. The thought cheered him up. But not as much as the thought of Jodie Carmichael driving herself and her fat boyfriend out of the garage tomorrow morning did. Chapter 110. Friday the 13th of March. J. Paul Cornell stifled a yawn, enjoying the aroma of the massive Armagnac that Jodie had poured him, then puffed on the last few inches of the fat Cohiba cigar. Patting his belly contentedly, he said,
"Geez, you spoiled me tonight. What a meal. Divine scallops and the most perfectly cooked steak. You know, I can't remember ever eating a better steak."
Actually, he could. It was full of gristle and she'd overcooked it. But he wasn't about to tell her that. The high-backed perspex chair at the glass dining table was cripplingly uncomfortable, but he wasn't about to tell her that either. "You're a true genius as a chef. Apple crumble and custard, my favourite dessert."
"Nothing's too good for you. I'm loving your company."
"And me yours."
He yawned.
"Look at the time. Almost midnight. Where did the evening go?"
"I had no idea it was so late," she said. "It's been such fun."
"It has. Think I'm pretty much ready to hit the sack. I'm afraid my medication has that effect on me."
"Your room's all made up."
"A few years back, and I'd have made love to you all night."
He raised his glass.
"My lovely Jodie, where have you been all my life?"
She raised her drambuie.
"God, how I wish I'd met you sooner. I wonder how different my life might have been," he said.
"It's never too late, is it?"
"I'll drink to that."
He drained his glass, stubbed out the remainder of his cigar, and stood up unsteadily.
"I don't have a toothbrush."
"I've got a spare one."
"You're an angel."
"True," she said.
They both smiled.
"I wish, you know, that I could make love to you," he said.
She kissed him on the cheek.
"Let's get you to bed."
"Good plan."
"What would you like for breakfast?"
"You," he said.
"I think I can arrange that."
10 minutes later, she led him upstairs. Cornell noticed her cat scratching a wall at the end of the corridor.
"What's he after?"
he quizzed her.
"I think he's mousing. He keeps doing that.
Maybe there's a mouse in the cavity wall.
Tyson!
She shouted. The cat shot off along the landing and down the stairs. There seemed to be a lot of scratches at the bottom of the wall, as well as a few shallow grooves. What, he wondered, was the other side of it? Her snakes? He would try to take a discreet closer look when he had the opportunity. A few minutes later, with J. Paul Cornell safely installed in the guest bedroom with ensuite bathroom, Jodie went back downstairs to clear up. She was feeling pretty good about how the day had gone, but, she knew, she needed to deepen the bond between them. He seemed to be a bit guarded, and she needed to break that down. How? He had confessed his impotence due to a prostate operation. Maybe if she could arouse him despite what he had said, that would do the trick. Perhaps later, she would slip into his bed, naked, and try. She topped up her drambuie, lit another cigarette, and sat at the kitchen table. She liked him, which was as well, she thought, if she was intending to marry him. A copy of the Argus newspaper lay there. As she sipped her liqueur and smoked, idly flipping through the pages, her eyes were suddenly drawn to a story. Sussex police officer to receive posthumous Queen's Gallantry Medal. It wasn't so much the headline that caught her eye, but the photograph below. D.S. Bella Moy with her Sussex police officer fiancé, D.S. Norman Potting. An attractive brunette in her mid-30s, with her arm round a large man of indeterminate age, mid to late 50s at least. She read through the article. The two detectives were engaged to be married. Then, tragically, whilst off duty, Potting's fiancée had bravely entered a burning house to rescue a child and dog trapped inside. The child and her dog had got out, but D.S. Bella Moy had failed to emerge. Her body was recovered some hours later. And now she remembered something that Paul had said to her over dinner last night.
I lost my soulmate in a house fire.
His whole expression had changed after he had uttered those words. Last night, she had taken it as someone very private, revealing too much about himself. She stared back at the photograph, concentrating hard on the man, the shape of his face, the slightly bulbous nose, the thinning hair in a comb-over, the short bull neck. Feeling a prickle of unease, she opened the lid of her laptop and googled Sussex Police Norman Potting images. A whole raft of photographs appeared. Some were of total strangers, but others looked remarkably like a shabbier version of J. Paul Cornell. Was she imagining it? Was he just a lookalike? Was she being too cautious after the Walt Klein fiasco? There was one way she might find out. She googled J. Paul Cornell and started to sift through his images, taking screenshots of each. Chapter 111. Friday the 13th of March. Norman Potting was in danger, and there was no one immediately available to protect him. Cleo was feeding Noah, and Grace sat up with her thinking hard. Should he break with all the rules, drive down to Rodine Crescent and be on hand for Norman? He had confided the UC's identity to Cleo, which he knew she would keep secret. Half an hour later, just approaching midnight, Noah was sound asleep and Cleo collapsed exhausted into bed. "Try to sleep, darling," she said. "You won't be any use to Norman if you're too tired." He yawned.
"You're right."
He reached out and turned off his bedside light, but then after a few moments switched it back on.
"I'm sorry," he said. "I can't leave him exposed like this. I've got to go and check he's okay."
"Do what you've got to do. Just be careful and get back as soon as you can. You have to have some sleep." He dressed, pulled on a warm coat, made himself a quick espresso, and calmed Humphrey, who seemed to think it was morning. He wiped the mist off the Alpha's windows, started the engine, and drove fast towards Brighton. 15 minutes later, he turned into Rodine Crescent and slowed, looking at the house numbers in the dark street. The odd numbers were on the left-hand side. He put the window down and shone his torch, driving slowly, passing a few parked cars with misted windows, indicating they had been there for some while, until he reached number 191. He carried on. A cat shot across the road a short distance in front of him. He cruised the area, turning down all the side streets, looking for any suspicious vehicle where Tooth might be lurking, although it was quite possible that the hitman was having the same difficulties as they'd had in locating Jodie Carmichael's real residence until Potting had established it.
He drove back along Rodine Crescent, halted a good 100 yards from the entrance to the drive, switched his lights off, climbed out, and walked back. In case Jody had night vision CCTV cameras, something he wouldn't have put past her, considering her form, he just ambled slowly past, like any man out taking a late stroll, glancing down the driveway as he passed. He could see the silhouette of the house directly below, which appeared to be in complete darkness. Norman Potting was in there, somewhere asleep, according to the latest update. Grace crossed the road and walked back along the other side, barely glancing at the driveway this time, then crossed over again and got back into his car. Still looking around and thinking, wondering just what was going on in that house right now. According to the duty handler, who was listening to every word that was exchanged between Potting and Jody Carmichael, not much. Potting had gone to bed, alone. He looked at his watch. It was coming up to 1 a.m. Despite the espresso, he felt leaden, and thought back to Cleo's words, that he'd be no use to Norman if he was too tired. He felt exhausted. He drove home. Chapter 112, Saturday, the 14th of March. Jody, wide awake, sat up in bed staring at her laptop, her room lit only by the dimmed headboard lights and the glow from her screen. For the past hour, she'd been saving the few photographs of Cornell that she could find on Google and on other search engines onto her computer, as well as all the photographs she could find of Detective Sergeant Norman Potting. When she had finished, she double-clicked on one image of Cornell. A window appeared, with a request for her to enter his name. She did so, and instantly all 7 newspaper and online photographs of Norman Potting showed up as a potential match, each with a blue tick against them, giving her the opportunity to confirm or reject any. She stared at the faces. The computer confirmed her increasing suspicions that they were a match, that J. Paul Cornell and Detective Sergeant Norman Potting were the same person. But how the hell could they be? Cornell had a long history on the internet, a trail of stuff going back 20 years or more. Were there just uncanny facial similarities between the 2 men?
I lost my soulmate in a house fire.
Was Cornell perhaps talking about a girlfriend way back in the past who had died?
She heard the click of a door opening.
Stealthily, she switched off the lights altogether, closed the lid of her laptop, tiptoed across the thick carpet to the door in the darkness, and listened. She heard the creak of a floorboard. Then another. Cornell trying to walk along the landing quietly. She saw a streak of light, just for an instant. Then again. Holding her breath, she opened the door and peered out. And saw him at the end of the corridor, crouched down, examining the scratches. She watched him for as long as she dared, then slowly drew her head back into her room. Her heart was thudding.
You want to know what's behind that wall, do you? Strange behaviour for a billionaire who professed a short while ago to be so tired. Maybe I should show you what's really behind that wall, Detective Sergeant Norman Potting. You bastard.
After a few minutes, she heard his footsteps creeping back. Another creak of a floorboard. Then the click of his door once more. She closed her own silently, and switched her headboard spots back on. Then she checked and rechecked the faces of Cornell and Potting. She gave it a while, then removed her clothes and put on her dressing gown. Holding her phone, she slipped out of her room. She crossed the landing and stood still outside the guest bedroom door. He was snoring loudly. She opened the door as quietly as she could, just a few inches. If he woke, her plan was to slip sexily into bed beside him, whispering that she couldn't sleep. She switched on the phone torch and played the beam across the room. There was no change in the snoring. His jacket was hanging on the back of the dressing table chair. Holding her breath, Jody inched towards it, slipped her hand into the inside right pocket, and felt the bulge of his wallet. She eased it out and turned back towards the door. As she did so, she saw that his watch on his bedside table was lying on its side, and there appeared to be an inscription on the back plate. She picked it up, not wanting to risk waking him up by shining the light too near his face. 2 minutes later, he was back in her room, with the door shut. She switched on the overhead light, opened the wallet, and began to rummage through it. There was an electronic room key for the Grand Hotel, American Express and Visa credit cards in the name of J. Paul Cornell, along with a Californian-registered U.S. driver's license. There was nothing in it to confirm her suspicions. She then examined the back of the watch and saw, in tiny engraved Gothic script, N. Love B. XX. She stared at it, her hands shaking with anger.
"You bastard," she whispered.
Her first reaction was to go storming into his room, confront him with the watch, and kick him straight out. She had to calm down, she knew. Calm down and think this through.
"You bastard."
She thought back on today, and to the previous evening. Had she told him anything incriminating? Almost certainly he was wearing some kind of wire or transmitter. The police would know her address now. What else did they know that they could pin on her? She carefully replaced the contents in the wallet, in the order in which she had found them. Then, turning the lights off again, holding her phone, she tiptoed back out into the corridor and stood, listening outside his door. He continued snoring loudly. Gently, she pushed it open. As she did so, she heard a purring sound, and Tyson brushed up against her right leg. She pushed the cat away and slid into the room one step at a time. There was sufficient ambient green light from the glow of the clock radio for her to make out his jacket again. As she reached it, she heard the rustle of bedding and froze.
"Eh?" he grunted. "Eh?"
he shouted out. She didn't move a muscle. There was another rustle, a loud snort, and then he began snoring again. Shivering from the icy blast of air coming in through his open window, she waited several seconds, then slipped the wallet back inside his jacket. His snoring continued. She placed the watch on the bedside table, edged towards the door, backed out, and closed it. Down the end of the landing, Tyson was once again scratching noisily on the wall. She switched on the torch again and shone it at him.
"Tyson," she whispered.
He gave her a sulky look and stopped. She continued staring at the wall, thinking about what lay on the other side of it. Tempted. Oh, so tempted to teach this copper a lesson he would never forget. Because if she did what she was sorely tempted to do, he wouldn't live long enough to forget. Chapter 113. Saturday, the 14th of March. Norman was woken by his bladder, as he was most nights, and lay confused, trying to figure out where he was. The room was filled with an eerie green glow. Green digits in the darkness said 3:03 a.m. His head was pounding.
Where the hell?
Then he remembered. He swung his feet out of bed and his toes sank into deep pile carpet. Steadying himself with his hands, he blinked, staring into the green-hued darkness. Heaving himself upright, stark naked, he tottered unsteadily, feeling disoriented, worried he might fall backwards onto the bed. Finally, he trusted himself to take a step forward. Where were the light switches? He reached down, groping on the bedside table for his phone. Then he found the lamp and the cord attached to it. A short distance along the cord, he touched the switch and pressed it. Nothing happened. The pressure on his bladder was worse now he was standing. The bathroom was dead ahead. He took a few steps and collided with something, a chair. The bathroom door was to the right. He groped his way forward, felt the door, pulled it open and went in, fumbling for the switch. It was to his left, he remembered. But his fingers touched cold, bare tiles. Was it on the right? He eventually found it and pressed it, and instantly squinted against the bright light and the image facing him in the mirror. A tiny loo was through the door to the right. He pushed it open, went in, saw the light switch on the left and pressed it. Immediately a dim light came on. He shut the door and lifted the toilet seat, and was about to relieve himself when he noticed what at first looked like a shadow moving down the wall. Then, when he saw what it actually was, he shook with fear. A furry black spider, the size of his hand, with orange markings. It was staring at him, creeping slowly down the wall, a thread unspooling behind it from the ceiling, as if it was abseiling. It was level with his face now.
no more than a foot from his face. Breaking into a cold sweat, he moved back as far as he could, his head pressing against the wall behind him, looking frantically for a weapon. Was there a toilet plunger? All he could spot was the toilet roll holder. He could see bristles on the creature's abdomen, and its eyes, 8 black, shiny beads staring at him, fearless, hungry, angry. He moved a hand to his right, towards the toilet roll. Rivulets of perspiration ran down his body. He tried to call to Jody for help, but no sound came out. He tried again, but his voice was paralyzed by fear. He stared into the eyes. His hand touched the toilet roll, tried to free it, but it wouldn't move. The spider crawled down another few inches. Instinctively, he covered his penis and testicles with his left hand and yanked hard on the toilet roll. Suddenly, with a loud clatter, it came free and dropped down between the wall and the toilet seat. Then, like an acrobat, the spider swung on its thread away from the wall and straight at him, its hairy, spiky legs clamping onto his face. He screamed, shook in terror, screamed again, 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 shook, trying to shake the bloody thing off. 1,000 pinpricks stabbed his skin simultaneously. "Help me! Help me!" Suddenly, all he could see was a weak green glow. The dial of the clock. 4:07 a.m. He lay back in bed, the sheets sodden with his perspiration, gulping air, and bursting to have a pee. For some moments he fought it off, still filled with stark terror from the nightmare. He reached out his hand, found the bedside lamp cable, then switched it on. Instantly the room flooded with light. He stared fearfully up at the ceiling and the walls, at a framed oil painting of a rainy Parisian street scene, at another framed painting of a Provençal village. He slipped out of bed and crossed over to the bathroom, pulled the door open warily, found the light switch and turned it on. He peered around before entering, then, even more warily, pushed open the loo door. He took a step in, snapping on the light and looking up at the ceiling and around at the walls and the floor. There was nothing in there. All the same, he was as fast as he could be, then went back out, shutting the door firmly before rinsing his hands and going back into the bedroom, shutting that door firmly too. He climbed back into bed, wide awake and too scared to go back to sleep. It seemed only moments later that his alarm was beeping and the room was flooded with daylight. He was too relieved to notice his head pounding from all the Armagnac he had drunk the previous night. Chapter 114. Saturday, the 14th of March. After a sleepless night fretting about D.S. Norman Potting, Jody Carmichael finally gave up on trying to get any rest and went into her bathroom. Standing under the jets of the shower, she was trying hard to think everything through. She was reasonably satisfied she'd said nothing to Detective Sergeant Potting that the police could use against her. What exactly was his game plan? To try to take a look around her house for evidence. Good luck with that one. The only thing she had here that she could in theory be arrested for was the memory stick and the stash of dollars she'd taken in New York. It made her smile that the dollars were sewn inside the mattress that he had spent the night sleeping on. She doubted very much that the owner of the memory stick and cash would have made a complaint to the police. She thought about seeing the detective studying the landing wall last night. If he brought in a search team, they would find the reptile room. And then? So her first husband, Christopher Bentley, a reptile expert, had died from a snake bite. So had Rowley Carmichael in India, from a bite from a snake that killed 158 people a day in that country. So she kept saw-scaled vipers, among other pets, in her home. So she didn't have a license for them here in Brighton. But she had inherited most of them from her late husband, Christopher Bentley, and still kept up a valid license for them under his name, at the address of her London bolt hole, a small flat in South Kensington. The police might rumble and bust her little secret Brighton address, her bedsit flat near the Seven Dials, but they'd find nothing there. She would always be one step ahead of them. Were they going to try to show that she'd taken a snake with her in her luggage on the cruise? No way, Jose. Keep your friends close, and your enemies even closer. Shrewd, she thought. For a few hours at least, with luck, she would have the jump on that fat oaf detective. Maybe if she was smart and gave nothing away, she could glean information from him.
Men were weak creatures. If his prostate problem was his cover, his lie for not sleeping with her, then maybe, if she could seduce him once and record it, she'd have a hold over him. Men didn't reject her advances. They found her irresistible. A plan began to formulate in her mind. A couple of minutes later, she stepped out of the shower, dried herself, brushed her teeth, and sprayed on some perfume. She put on her dressing gown, activated her phone's voice recorder, and slipped it into her pocket, then went out onto the landing, rapped once, softly, and opened the guest bedroom door, ready to slip into bed with her guest, smother him with kisses, and work him into a frenzy. To her dismay, he was standing up, fully dressed. "Good morning," she said breezily, recovering the situation. "Just wanted to see what you'd like for breakfast, as you forgot to leave your order hanging on the door."
"So I did," he laughed, then shrugged. "Well, I guess I'll go along with whatever you're having."
"Bacon and eggs, black pudding, fried bread, tomatoes and mushrooms. Would that hit the spot?"
"A full English? How could I resist? But I have a really important conference call booked to my suite at the hotel for 9 a.m, which I have to be there for. So what I'll do is call a cab, go back to the hotel, take the call, shower and change while I'm there, and pick up a newspaper on the way. I normally get the Saturday Financial Times mailed to me every week in the U.S. Then perhaps we could have that breakfast when I'm back."
"It'll be on the table already. Oh, if you're getting papers, could you pick up a Mail, Times, and an Argus newspaper for me?"
"Sure." He looked at his watch. "I could be back here in, say, an hour and a half."
She walked up to him, placed her hands lightly on his shoulders, and, looking into his eyes, said, "That's too long. I'll miss you. I really enjoy your company. Try to make it sooner." He placed his hands on her shoulders.
"I'll do what I can to be as quick as possible."
She detected a faint change in his expression.
"The other option is we have breakfast back at my hotel. How would that sound? Save you the trouble of cooking."
Why was he suggesting that, she wondered. Had he been making calls during the night? Testing him, she said, "Hotel dining rooms are so impersonal. I think breakfast should be a very private occasion, don't you?"
"I've never thought about that."
"It can be the most romantic of all meals, if you were the right person. And best of all, naked in bed." She cocked her head and then gave him a light kiss on the forehead. "You know how you can tell the difference in a hotel between lovers and old married couples?"
"No."
"How?" "Lovers are the ones there talking to each other. The married couples are the ones sitting in silence reading newspapers while they eat."
He nodded. "I guess I'd buy that."
"And mostly the true lovers are having their breakfast in bed up in their rooms." She cocked her head again with a smile. "I bought everything for a really nice breakfast. I'd hate it to go to waste. How about I drive you in the Merc? It's a glorious morning. We could put the roof down, and it would save you the cost of a cab. I can wait for you while you change and get the papers to save time."
"Well, that's a very kind offer, but that would delay you getting breakfast ready. I'm already pretty peckish."
"Good point. Hey, you told me last night how much you love cars. I have a very beautiful 500 SL. Take it. It'll save time waiting for a cab, and you'd have fun."
He nodded. "Well, if you'd be happy with that."
"Of course."
"And you'd trust me not to run off with it?"
"I think I would."
"Well, I guess it would be kind of fun to drive over here on the wrong side again."
"The wrong side?" she chided. "Wrong side for who?" He grinned, then looked serious for a moment.
"Is there any issue with insurance?"
"You don't need to worry. You're a police officer. You're probably insured to drive anything," she thought. "No, any responsible adult can drive my car. Are you a responsible adult?"
He grinned again. "I hope I never will be."
"Don't be. There are far too many of those already in the world. It's one of the things I like so much about you, your naughty streak. You're still a kid at heart, aren't you?"
"Well, that's how you make me feel. I don't think I ever met anyone who made me feel the way you do."
"Me neither," she said. She leaned forward and kissed him on the forehead again. "Come downstairs. I'll get you the car keys.
The sooner you go, the sooner you'll be back.
What do you say in this country about, you know, going home the next day in the same clothes you went out in? He asked.
The walk of shame.
Huh, same in America. Yes, that's what I'm doing right now. The walk of shame.
Been there, done that. Didn't get the T-shirt, though. Was still wearing it from the night before.
He laughed.
Tooth, dressed in his normal clothes, ready to catch a plane, was parked down a side street a few hundred yards from Jody's house, hopefully safely off the dog-walking route of that noisy neighbourhood watch bitch from yesterday. He listened in growing horror to the conversation. Nothing ever panicked him, usually, but he was as close to it as he'd ever been at this moment, as, on his laptop screen, he watched Jody walk down the stairs, followed by the American.
Oh, shit, 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 no!
He watched her slide open the drawer in the hall table and pull out the car keys. He had seconds, he knew, to act. Making his decision, he flung open the car door, slamming it behind him and hitting the central locking button on his key, then sprinted, uncomfortably, up to Rodine Crescent, turned right and raced, limping, along to number 191.
Jody kissed Potty on the lips and said, "Drive safe, Paul. Hurry back."
She pointed at the door in the kitchen that led directly through to the integral garage.
"The garage clicker's in the car. Right by the gear lever."
"Thanks. It's an automatic?"
"Absolutely."
"Okay. I'll be right back."
"Hasta la vista, babe."
She gave him another kiss on the lips. As he reached the garage door, she was already halfway back up the stairs. She was going to use the next hour, or however long she had, to check out the reptile room, and, in particular, Silas. Just how the hell had whatever he'd eaten got into his vivarium? Hurrying along the landing and into the spare room, she grabbed the remote and pressed the button, then opened the glass door and went straight across to Silas. The boa constrictor was curled up inside his vegetation, looking content.
"What have you eaten?" she asked. "I need to know. Let's have a look at you, shall we? Are you going to be a good boy?"
The creature, now approximately 12 years old, was 9 feet long. Her late husband, Christopher, had warned her never to try to handle a boa on her own. He told her there should always be two of them in the room. If the creature became nervous for any reason, its natural self-protective instinct would be to wind itself round whatever it perceived to be the threat. When the snake had been younger and smaller, he had demonstrated this by handing it to her and scaring it by shouting loudly. Before she'd had time to react, lightning fast, the snake had coiled round her arms, pinning them to her midriff, then wound its body round her neck. Within seconds, it had begun to crush her neck, suffocating her. She'd tried desperately to free herself, but the strength of the reptile had been too much. She was close to choking when Christopher had freed her by unwinding its head and tail.
"You bastard!"
she'd spluttered as the pressure came off and he lifted the snake away, placing it back in its vivarium.
"Why the hell did you do that?"
He'd just laughed. She could still remember, years later, how he had looked into her eyes. "I love you, my darling. I want you always to be safe. Now you've experienced the power of these creatures for yourself, you'll be safe around them. Okay?" It had been a good lesson. She lifted the lid carefully.
"Hi, Silas," she said. "So, what have you eaten?"
Norman Potting pushed open the interior door to the spotlessly clean double garage. He was scanning it for any obvious clues. He saw the gleaming blue Mercedes sports car, as well as a hybrid mountain bike, and a helmet on a shelf above it, a stack of suitcases, a red plastic crate on a shelf piled high with newspapers, and a row of gardening tools on hooks. To his surprise, the garage door was already up. As Tooth, panting from his sprint and in deep discomfort, reached Jody's front door, he heard the roar of an engine and saw the blue Mercedes, with a man in a baseball cap behind the wheel, accelerate hard up the steep driveway. The car turned left and shot off down the road.
Shit, shit, shit!
Breaking her goddamn neck would have to do instead. He looked into the kitchen, the dining room, the living room, but all were empty. Then he hauled himself up the stairs. The reptile room wall at the end of the landing was open. Through the glass door, he saw her, facing away from him, peering into a vivarium.
Just as he rushed forward, he heard a massive explosion that shook the windows and doors in the house. Jody felt the floor of the house shake as she heard the deep boom somewhere close by. Jesus, what the hell? As she turned, in shock, to run and find out what it was, she saw a small, wiry, shaven-headed, furious-looking stranger in an anorak, jeans and trainers hurtling through the door of the reptile room towards her, holding a long, pointed blade. She had no time to think. She just acted instinctively in self-defense, doing the only thing she could think of. Finding almost superhuman strength from somewhere, in her panic, she heaved the heavy boa constrictor out of its vivarium and hurled it straight at him. The creature hit him full in the chest, its weight halting him in his tracks, knocking him off balance, sending him stumbling backward against a wall. "Yer!" the man yelled as the snake instantly began winding itself round him and bit him on the hand. "Yow!" he yelled, trying frantically to shake the snake free, but it responded by wrapping itself tighter round him, pinning his arms to his sides, then continuing to wind round his shoulders and then neck. He could feel its strength crushing him. "Get him off me, you bitch!" Jody grabbed a glass vivarium containing four tarantulas, raised it in the air, and held it up above her head. "Who the hell are you?" she shouted. "Are you police?" He looked up at the spiders, terrified. "Who the fuck are you?" he shouted back. "Jody? Judith?" "Both of them," she replied clearly. "And more." "Get this thing off me!" "Oh yes, and then what?" She raised the vivarium higher, as if preparing to hurl it at him. "No! No! Please! I hate those critters! Please! Look, lady, I'll go away! I promise!" The snake was winding more tightly round his throat, and it was getting harder for him to speak.
"Like I believe you. You know something? I've killed three people, two husbands and a fiancé. Actually, four, if you count my stupid sister. You think I care a toss about some shitty intruder?"
"Please! Please get us off me!"
He was finding it even harder to gulp down air. He stared up, wide-eyed with fear, at the undersides and hairy legs of the spiders.
"Help you? Tell me who the hell you are!"
she yelled. His voice was coming out as a croak now.
"Get this thing off me and I'll..."
She slammed down the vivarium on his head, knocking him sideways and onto the floor. It shattered, freeing the spiders. She picked up another vivarium containing three light brown-coloured Deathstalker scorpions and brought that crashing down on the floor beside his head. As it shattered, freeing the scorpions, she took several steps back towards the door and saw, to her satisfaction, one of them crawling across his face.
"Houses!"
he screamed, writhing in terror, his face bleeding in several places as the boa increasingly tightened its grip.
"Who are you?"
she said.
"Who are you?"
He stared back at her in silence, shaking. She raced past him and threw the open glass door, slamming it shut behind her, shaking with fear and relief and confusion.
"Who are you?"
she screamed again through the door. He just stared back, transfixed in terror. Was he a police officer? But he had an American accent, couldn't be. So who was he? His face was turning blue. A tarantula was crawling down his neck. A scorpion, its sting poised, was standing over his eyes. The boa was coiling tighter and tighter round his neck.
"Help me, please,"
she heard him gasping.
"Help, have, please, please help."
His eyes were bulging as if they were going to pop and stared at her, imploring, "Have some pity." She watched the scorpion crawling over his cheek. Then she went into the spare room, picked up the remote, and pressed the button. Instantly the false wall began sliding back into place, blocking the stranger from her sight and blocking out his rasping screams. She didn't do pity. Chapter 115. Saturday, the 14th of May. Norman Potting had just reached the top of the drive, racing after the car, when the blast threw him off his feet. He picked himself up and stared in momentary dumb shock and disbelief at the scene in front of him, 100 yards or so along the road. It was like something out of a war movie. He saw the blazing skeletal remains of the convertible Mercedes and a Range Rover that had been parked in the road on fire beside it.
a solid lump of a smouldering engine, rested against the garden wall yards from where he stood. Even closer, in the middle of the road, just feet away, he saw a blackened human arm, wearing a wristwatch. Two wheels, attached to an axle, lay a short distance further on. Unable to help himself, and shaking uncontrollably, he threw up. His confused mind was in turmoil. Was this Jody's doing? Had she engineered him to be driving her car? Just who the hell was the shifty-looking character in the baseball cap who'd been sitting in the driver's seat as he entered the garage and had raced away in the Mercedes? His professionalism began to kick in. Pulling out his phone and giving his identity, his voice full of panic, he requested all the emergency services and, panting with exertion, ran forward as close as he could get to the inferno. 20 feet away, the searing heat was so intense he had to stop impotently. All he could do was watch transfixed, thinking, "This would have been me." He also called his handler, asking for urgent backup, and then Roy Grace. "Stay where you are, Norman. Don't go back into the house. We have armed response and a full team on their way."
"Thank you, Chief."
Then he began to shake uncontrollably once more. Staring at the fireball, all he could think again was that person driving could have been him, should have been him. He tried to piece the last few minutes together. Who the hell was the man driving the car? People were starting to appear from every direction around him, some of them holding up phone cameras. He saw a woman with two small children staring, frozen. As he heard the first distant siren, he began shouting at them,
"Police! Keep back! Keep back!"
He saw another woman holding the hand of a small girl who was crying.
"You really want your child to see this?"
he yelled in blind fury as he noticed more charred human body parts everywhere amid the glass and debris from the car. All the time, he was thinking more and more clearly. Jody. That bitch had set him up. But who the hell was the poor sod in the car? For some moments he stood, uncertain what to do. He needed to go back to the house to get Jody, but he had to take charge of the scene. Were there any casualties other than the driver? He realized that the way he was dressed, he looked pretty improbable as a police officer. A woman was screaming hysterically, only yards from him. He saw her with a large dog tugging on a leash, trying to restrain it from reaching a human head and part of a spinal cord only a few feet in front of her. He looked over at Jody's house, at a line of cars backed up down the street. Christ! Christ! Sirens were coming closer. More and more people were appearing.
Back! He yelled at them. Stay back! There might be another explosion!
There were also people gathering on the far side of the car, but the heat was too intense to run past it. To his relief, he saw strobing blue lights. The first siren came closer, and he saw a patrol car. He ran up to it as it halted, holding up his hands and jabbered out a quick summary. As he finished, another patrol car, followed by an ambulance with a fire engine in its wake, were all approaching. He broke into a fast, lumbering run back towards Jody's house, down her steep drive and in through the open garage door.
"Jody!" he yelled. "Jody!"
She came down the stairs, looking pale in her dressing gown.
"What's happened?" she said. "Paul, what's happened?"
"I'll tell you what's happened, young lady."
He strode over to her before she had a chance to move, grabbed her right wrist roughly, then swung her arm up behind her in a half-Nelson hold.
"I'm arresting you on suspicion of attempted murder. That's what's happened."
He was shaking like a leaf. But he wasn't going to blow this by putting a damned foot wrong, despite the state he was in.
"You do not have to say anything, but it may harm your defense if you do not mention when questioned something which you later rely on in court. Anything you do say may be given in evidence."
Something valuable he had learned about over the years he had worked with Roy Grace was the psychology of the behavior of suspects. Genuinely innocent people often tended to resist arrest vociferously, and sometimes quite aggressively. But most guilty suspects became like putty in your hands, almost as if relieved the game was finally up. She felt like putty now.
"Attempted murder? What are you talking about?"
"You wanted me to take your car, didn't you?"
"Yes."
"So who just drove off in it?"
"Someone drove off in it. Who?"
"You tell me."
"I'm sorry, Paul. I don't know what you're talking about. What was that noise just now, that explosion?"
He wrenched her arm further up her back, so hard she cried out in pain.
"You little bitch," he replied.
His phone rang. He answered with one hand and heard Roy Grace's voice.
"Norman, where are you?"
"In 191, holding my suspect."
Can you open the front door? There are officers outside. Potting, Frog marched her across and unlatched the door.
You'd better hurry, guys, Jody said with a smirk. One of your colleagues is upstairs, and he doesn't have very long to live, if he's even still alive.
Chapter 116, Saturday, the 14th of March. With Jodie's hands cuffed behind her back, Potting was right behind, escorting her up the stairs and along the corridor, followed by several officers. She stopped beside a door and turned to Potting.
There's a wardrobe just inside, to the left. If you open the door, you'll find a remote. Press it.
Potting did as he was told. Instantly, the wall at the end of the corridor slid open to reveal the glass door behind it.
Holy shit!
Someone exclaimed in horror. A small, shaven-headed man, in an anorak, jeans and trainers, his eyes bulging, lay on the floor, motionless, with an enormous brown and beige patterned snake entwined round his body and neck. Crawling about on the floor were several large black hairy spiders, as well as some light brown scorpions, one of which was on the man's neck.
"Don't go in!" said a voice behind them.
They all turned to see Detective Superintendent Roy Grace in a dark suit, shirt and tie, standing beside a man dressed like a beekeeper in a hooded white protective suit, padded gloves, and a large glass mask.
"This is Dr. Reardon, a reptile expert from London Zoo. He'll deal with this."
Public order officers were a tough bunch, used to dealing with anything. Norman Potting had never seen them step away with such relief on their faces as when the reptile expert moved forward.
"Be our guest," Potting said,
as Reardon opened the glass door, went through, and shut it rapidly behind him.
"Well, look who's in there."
"If it isn't our friend, Mr. Tooth," Grace said.
"What a surprise.
All wrapped up for me. And it isn't even my birthday." Chapter 117, Sunday, the 15th of March.
The time is 10:17 a.m., Sunday, the 15th of March. Interview with Jodie Carmichael in the presence of her solicitor, Clifford Orson, the Erskine bachelor said clearly, for the benefit of the video recorder above their heads. They were in the small interview room in Sussex House. Beside him, on another hard chair with little back support, sat DS Tanya Kale, who was also a trained advanced interviewer. The first interview had taken place on Saturday afternoon to establish certain facts and the background of the defendant, and for her to give an account. This second interview was to challenge some of her previous answers in light of the information subsequently discovered by the police investigation. Both Guy and Tanya were aware that Roy Grace was watching the live video feed in the tiny observation room next door, and they were also aware that they could only keep a suspect for 36 hours. To keep Jodie any longer, they would need to go before a magistrate and present good reasons for an extension. She had already been in custody now for just over 24 hours. They had until 10 o'clock this evening to charge her or else come up with grounds for seeking an extension. Across the table, littered with glasses of water and mugs of coffee, sat Jodie Carmichael, quiet and sullen, dressed in a black top and blue jeans, toying repeatedly with the chain of the locket round her neck. Beside her was her brief, a tough, sharp London solicitor from a leading criminal law practice, suited and booted, and with freshly gelled hair. He spoke with a strong Brummie accent. The two police officers were expecting a fight. "This is the second interview with Jodie Carmichael, née Danforth, also known as Jodie Bentley and Gemma Smith, among other possible names."
"Other names?" the lawyer interjected. "Would you care to specify them?"
Not at this stage. We are carrying out investigations into your client's background, and we believe she may have used other aliases in the past."
Then Batchelor looked at Jodie.
"You married Christopher Bentley when you were 22, is that correct?"
She glanced at her solicitor before answering.
"Yes. And am I correct in saying that some years into your..."